Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Wolverine 24/7 podcast, your audio source for all things Michigan football, basketball, and recruiting. I'm your host, Zach Shaw. Steve Lorenz here with me. And so we recorded a nice episode with three main topics, one of which was the state reallowing full capacity beginning June 1st for outdoor events. We discussed, well, now it sounds a little silly. We discussed the potential of Michigan eventually announcing that it would allow capacity or full capacity for the fall, or at least trend toward that. Obviously, nothing's official, but about 5 minutes after we stopped recording and hung up and moved on with our lives, Michigan did announce that it intends to have full capacity for the fall. So might be a couple choppy points during the episode where we might mention it. Just let that part go. We actually cut the conversation out because a lot of it was kind of discussing the decision or what we thought would happen, and we both agreed that it would be it was more of a when, not an if. We hypothesized, unfortunately it didn't age well, that they might take some time, see how it goes with the Tigers, but obviously with Michigan State announcing earlier today, a lot of teams in the state of Michigan were taking today as kind of the opportunity to say, yep, we'll be a part of the full capacity. So anyway, a lot of the conversation doesn't actually hold up. There is a couple components to keep an eye on, just, you know, the demographics of Michigan fans. They travel from further away. They often, a lot of them aren't from Ann Arbor. And then there's a bigger crowd than, say, a Tigers game or even a Michigan State game. Just the tailgating atmosphere mixed with the larger capacity at the stadium. So there was a couple points, but honestly, we just cut it out. It didn't really fit once the announcement that we discussed possibly happening indeed happened. And that's great news. There's certainly, everyone has different opinions about these COVID restrictions being lifted, but in the end, things are trending in the right direction. I think it's very hard to argue that. And then also, Michigan football is more fun, as a reporter like myself or as a fan, with fans in the stands. So to kind of get that stroke of good news on a Thursday evening, I got to think most fans were fired up about that. And the ones who aren't, don't have to go. So I think this was something that it seemed to be heading in this direction even before today's announcement from Gretchen Whitmer. But obviously now it is open. So anyway, that was kind of the genesis of our conversation. We expect pretty much unless there's a change in cases, unless there's another outbreak, I suppose, or another spike, expect pretty much all the outdoor events for sure to be full capacity this fall. Indoor, I guess I would expect it to eventually be full. I just don't know when it officially will. Michigan's order that goes into effect June 1st is only 50% for indoor. But anyway, you can read all of that over at themichiganinsider.com and elsewhere too. But the rest of our podcast does hold up. Some of it will age relatively quickly. So definitely, kind of a time sensitive episode, not one to shell for 2 or 3 days. We talk about grad transfers with the potential commitment of Oregon State defensive tackle Jordan Whitley. So we discuss a little bit of his impact, the questions that come with him, but also moving forward, how big of a deal is it for Michigan to get what we expect to be a backup defensive tackle transfer? And then does Michigan keep looking for defensive tackles? And then also at other positions, do they look at linebackers, cornerbacks? There's actually a couple positions I throw in there as maybe wild card spots to get a transfer too. So we have that. And then we close with a softball discussion, taking a look at Michigan's season so far, what has impressed us, what are the keys going to be heading into the NCAA tournament. And then we also actually talk about the NCAA tournament draw itself, because that's ruffled some feathers both in the Big Ten and the Pac-12. So a lot to get to. Hopefully it's not too choppy. If there is something that we mentioned that sounds outdated, you're going to have to forgive us. We just had to take about a third of the episode out. Anyway, we will skip the discussion about the capacity and jump right into this graduate transfer discussion. Anyways, back to the team. They seem to be trending toward landing Mr. Jordan Whitley out of Oregon State, a defensive tackle grad transfer listed at 350 pounds. So he's a big dude. I mean, he'd be 30 pounds heavier at least than any other defensive lineman on Michigan's roster. You know, he's had a very long journey as a football player. I mean, this would be his seventh year, and I think he technically is a year older than that too. So I think he's 25. But he was originally signed to be a running back at San Jose State. I believe it was grades prevented him from ever making it to campus. Played a few years at Laney College, which is a junior college in California, and then has spent three seasons at Oregon State, I believe. It might be two, but he did not play last season. Put up some solid numbers in 2019. You know, obviously a nose tackle, big defensive tackle, they're not going to put up, you know, the crazy sack numbers. Their thing is more just being there and helping the rest of the defense operate. But they seem to be trending up toward him. Steve, we've talked about it in bits and pieces before, but looking at Michigan's defensive line, knowing now what we know now that they're going to basically, it's going to be a defensive tackle line. I mean, they're not going to have anyone under 280 pounds putting their hand in the ground consistently. Anyone lighter, any of those traditional defensive ends, they're going to play stand up outside linebacker, play a little bit of an edge position. So they have Hinton, they have Chris Hinton, they have Donovan Jeter in terms of returning starters. Julius Welshoff, Mozzie Smith are the well-liked but still kind of inexperienced backups. And then from there, it's a little bit more of a mystery. So knowing what we know, 1 to 10, how important is it for Michigan to land a grad transfer, even if it's not a starter, but just kind of another rotation defensive tackle, defensive lineman who can add some size to that front seven?
I mean, I think it was imperative just about, right? I mean, I don't – even if – and that's the thing. Even if Smith, who I think is the one player I think most people are kind of saying, okay, like, you know, what do we got? You know, he was a highly recruited top 150 kid. Mm-hmm. The guy that Michigan fans have been waiting on now, this will be his third season on campus. You know, I think that people are like, hey, what, you know, even if he does take that step forward, this is really more about depth and keeping those other guys fresh, keeping a Jeter or a Hinton or a Smith fresh, right? Not somebody I think you're going to be bringing in looking to play like at an All-American type level. I think Whitley, if he commits, would have a pretty niche role for Michigan as a plug, you know, in the run game, a guy that I think, you know, the goal would be to try to attract attention, to give linebackers or the defensive, you know, your bigger defensive ends, some favorable one-on-one matchups, or for linebackers, either, you know, easier to get through on the blitz or to create space to make easy tackles in the run game. So, you know, I think from Michigan's standpoint, yeah, I mean, it's clear that this is something that they've coveted. You look at the way they're even recruiting. They're recruiting a lot of 300-plus kids in this 22 class. I mean, it's clear they're going to try to get a lot bigger up front. So I think it was a situation where I feel like they almost viewed this as a must, you know, to bring in somebody like this, you know, and see what they can do. And as just as an important piece for what McDonald and company want to do up front. So, Yeah, I mean, it's going to be interesting. You know, I think we talked a little bit before the show. It's a weird, like, definitely not the first guy they offered or recruited at this spot.
Right.
But they also didn't throw out, like, a ton of offers. You know, I think there was Antonio Shelton, the Penn State transfer who committed to Florida. Timmy Horn, who I can't even remember where he went, like TCU or something. And then there was John Ridgeway, the Illinois State kid who committed to Arkansas. And then you had Fair.
Yeah,
who the UAB transfer who committed to Auburn. So they did pursue a handful of guys, you know, but with Whitley, feels like, you know, Michigan has had a chance to pursue some other guys in the middle ahead of maybe not taking that opportunity. So for them to be pursuing him really, you know, literally almost immediately after he entered the portal, you know, to me says that there's something about him that they like. And yeah, I mean, his journey, you know, it's like Frodo trying to get to Mount Doom. You know, it's like he was in the same, that's why I was joking. He was in the same recruit. Well, it's not even a joke. It's a fact. Same recruiting class as Brian Monet and Michael Ferns and Jabril Peppers and all those guys. You know, it's like, that's how, you know, Jabril Peppers, I think, will be entering his fourth year in the NFL.
Yeah, he's going to be on a second contract.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, if that tells you how long of a road it's been for him. So,
and fifth year.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah, even more, right? So that being said, you know, I think one thing that'll be interesting with a kid like this, I keep saying kid, but he's not a kid. definitely be a sense of urgency, you know, and somebody who understands what it's taken for him to get where he's at now, you know, so there is that little factor. I think we saw that type of idea, Mike Dana, you know, kind of betting on yourself a little bit. The betting on yourself has worked better for Michigan in basketball, you know, with Chandy and Mike Smith. But I think there's some semblance to that with Jordan Whitley. It's just a matter of, you know, if he commits or not, but it feels like Michigan is a heavy favorite.
Well, yeah, they have to be a heavy favorite. You know, I don't mean this to sound disparaging, but the only other school that has offered that we have been able to see is Alabama Birmingham. You know, there's been other Power Five schools that have inquired or taken a look, been in touch, but I mean, it's kind of late in the process. I think a lot of schools that were pursuing defensive tackle transfers kind of got their guy or feel good enough with who they have. I think the one thing with Whitley, I don't think anyone would predict him to start. And I don't know if anyone would predict him to play like 40% of the snaps. He really would be kind of a specialty package type of player, just because of his size. You know, I think I personally would have questions about his conditioning just because he has had some serious health issues. And at one point, you know, there's been stories about Oregon State and Laney College both, you know, finding efforts to kind of help him with his dieting or with eating the right foods. You know, he admitted he really didn't know anything when he entered college, and his weight was up to 390 pounds at one point. So there would be some questions if he committed to Michigan, and I don't think he would be like the answer in the sense of, you know, solving Michigan's defensive problems. It's going to have to be solved elsewhere as well. But you know, adding a veteran, adding someone with experience, adding someone who's played at the Power Five level, adding someone who can rotate in at the least, you know, and as you mentioned, you know, give some guys some rest and maybe, I mean, defensive line, I've always found was one of the more injury prone position groups on the field. I don't know if the numbers bear that out, but that's the hunch I've always had. So yeah, I think in terms of the need level for Michigan, I think it was at 8, 9. I mean, and the fact that you mentioned some of the players they've offered, a lot of those came after spring ball ended. And so that tells me that, you know, this wasn't something that they kind of feel a need for. I think now they kind of really feel a need where they're like, hey, you know, we got to we can't be as picky and choosy. We got to find somebody is I think the mindset that Michigan's carrying. So, you know, we'll see what happens with his recruitment. But you know, I think you've mentioned before, Michigan does have some connections at Oregon State, excuse me. You know, this isn't a completely blind flyer type recruitment. This is someone that I think they kind of got a tip that he was going to enter the portal. And as soon as he did, according to him, they offered within a minute of him entering the portal. So, you know, going to be interesting to see how it goes. We're going to pause for a quick break. On the other side, we'll talk about other position groups Michigan might want to pursue a transfer at. Are there any still, and how important are they? And then we will close with some talk about the Michigan softball team. This is the Wolverine 24/7 podcast.
Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome back. Thanks for waiting. So as we mentioned just a moment ago, you know, I think Michigan, I don't know the exact scholarship count. I do think they have spots for a couple players in the transfer portal. You know, I know Bryce just did a post on our message board saying they wouldn't necessarily stop with Whitley. You know, they might pursue another defensive tackle to kind of flesh out the rotation or add somebody. And then I do think there are other position groups where they could definitely benefit from a transfer. Now we say this, obviously, if a superstar enters the transfer portal, Michigan's always going to reach out, you know, even no matter the position. I'm thinking more, can they find someone who might not light the world on fire, might not be an NFL draft pick, but can add some depth? Can they find someone like maybe a Mike Dana who is kind of betting on themselves, hoping to make it to the NFL, and could be a plus piece, whether they start or rotate in? And so, Steve, I think the position that jumps out the most to me as needing a transfer portal player, or just another player that could rotate in or contend for rotation snaps, is inside linebacker. I think outside linebacker, you know, with the edge position, I feel like they're well equipped there. I think they have a bunch of different types of players, and that might be actually one of the more stout positions of their team. But inside linebacker, they have Josh Ross, who I don't think Michigan fans are, I don't think anyone's penciling him in as a all Big Ten type of linebacker. And he's been a 3-year starter. So there's Josh Ross, there's Mike Barrett, who I think had some pretty strong moments last year, but he is switching to more of an inside role. And then everyone else is kind of either a freshman or essentially a redshirt freshman. You know, it's guys like Khalil Mullings, Nikai Hill Green, Junior Colson, talented players, but I think that there is absolutely room for Michigan to pursue a linebacker. I think you can be pickier at linebacker than defensive tackle. I think the need levels maybe like a 6 or a 7, but if Michigan's thinking if Michigan's goal is to have a top 10 defense this year, I think they absolutely need some help at linebacker. Your thoughts, is that the next most important position group for them to pursue a transfer?
I think so. I think corner still, just because you know, I think you think about Ohio State, other programs, you want as many coverage guys as you can find, but yeah, I think inside linebacker, absolutely. Just because they're so thin. Right. And I agree with Ross and Barrett, kind of an interesting deal where it feels like they're okay at the top. But like you said, both of them kind of have legit question marks, with Ross really, really struggling last year and Barrett kind of making that shift inside. You know, they love Nakai Hill-Green. They love Junior Colson. I think they like Mullings too. As I posted on the VIP chat today, I was told, Mullings had a little bit of an up and down spring camp. I don't take that to mean, like, I think people hear up and down and will lean more towards the down. I just think that means he's learning. You know, I think the talent and the athleticism is there as well, but he might not be as far along. You know, Colson, I think, still has some learning to do. I feel like Nakai Hill-Green's the next guy, though, best way to put it. So, yeah, I think from a depth standpoint, you know, I think backer probably the best spot. And, yeah, because on the outside, there's actually, like, a lot of guys. you know, you got Ojabo, Harrell, Hutchinson, McGregor, Newberg. Mike Morris has been playing on the outside a little bit. It's just there's, like, a ton of guys at that spot.
Definitely, you know, seems like a Wisconsin situation where they might play two edge guys at the same time.
I don't see how you don't, given what you have, right? I mean, if you don't think any of those guys are capable of playing inside, which I don't I don't know how you could, then I think you have to. I mean, if you're going to put your best 11 on the field, you know, it's like, what if a guy like McGregor blows up? You know, he's finally healthy. What if he comes to fall camp and, like, tears it up? It's like, yeah, you got a bunch of guys on the edge, but
drew a lot of comparisons to Aiden Hutchinson out of high school.
Right. So. You know, and now he's like made his way back, you know, but, and we hear a lot of great things about Mike Morris and Harrell and Ojabo. It's just like, they're like really, really deep there. And so it's, you know, how they kind of, I know they want to go with the 3-4, but man, I mean, it just still feels like a 4-3 fits the roster a little bit better.
Well, and there's ways to get creative. I think
they can't
help but wonder if it's like a 2-5-4 ends up being into play, you know, two big tackles, two edge guys.
I just, if you're putting your best 11 on the field, right? I mean, there's a lot of different ways you could do it. And I do suspect, and I know this, I mean, we've been told, I mean, that they're not married to one package necessarily. It's just clear that the long-term plan is for a 3-4 base. I mean, that's the way they're recruiting, and it's, you know, you see the guys that have transferred out, you know, it's clear that they're moving towards larger outside linebackers, bigger on the interior, just bigger on the defensive line, period. So yeah, I think corner and linebacker, but I agree that I think inside linebacker, just because, you know, it reminds me of safety last year when we talk about how they were pretty solid at the top, but they were one, if they had one or two injuries, they were in big trouble because they have talent, but zero experience. And that's kind of how it feels at linebacker. Cause, and again, we feel like we talk about this every time we talk about this stuff, but you know, for some inexplicable reason, on this 2-4 Michigan team last year, none of these young linebackers got any run in a legitimate.
Yeah. You know, they were playing walk-ons instead of the freshmen.
And you're running out a very subpar defense, and you have young 4-star level, you know, Nakai Hill-Green was a 4-star, you know, I know Mullings is the guy, the All-American, got a lot of the pub, but Hill-Green was a 4-star prospect on our, for 24/7 himself. And we didn't see these guys at all. And to me, that was a lost opportunity. You know, these are guys that you wouldn't maybe have been able to call them seasoned, but they're still green going into this year because for some reason they did not get put out on the field in any capacity last year in any scenario that meant anything, you know? And so that puts Michigan in a position now where, yeah, like I feel like, and Bryce was right. I mean, we've been saying it for a while. Defensively, they're still keeping their ears to the ground. I don't think they're married to taking anybody else if they don't have to, but I think if they find the right fit, I absolutely think they'll pursue. I think they're exhausting avenues. I think there are a couple defensive backs they're looking at. Linebacker, I agree. I think they will be looking and have been looking, but you know, yeah, I'd agree though. Linebacker definitely one of the two spots are the other ones, but safety doesn't feel like they really need to make any pursuits there. And obviously, like we said, not on the edge at all.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, honestly, at the edge, it's really crowded as it is. But yeah, I actually do think corner is another position just because there's optimism about Jamon Green. There's optimism about the winner of the Vincent Gray, DJ Turner, but I don't think any of them looked like all Big Ten cornerbacks last season. And that is there's reason why it can't be a realistic standard. But if you're Michigan's coaches, I think you look at every single position group and you say, is there a potential all Big Ten player at this position? And if there isn't, then you should be looking in the portal. You don't have to offer everyone in the portal, but you should be looking in. And I suspect Michigan is kind of doing that. You know, another position group that I think gets underrated in terms of portal needs, two of them actually stand out to me: kicker and tight end. You know, Jake Moody's the projected kicker. He lost his job last season. He's lost his job twice actually in the past two seasons. And then at tight end, you know, Eric All, continues to get the practice hype, but he didn't play a ton last season. He had the drops. You know, still feel like if there's a veteran, you know, who's played at the Power Five level that enters that portal or someone really intriguing, I think Michigan should go because they are kind of thin at tight end. And that's with Eric All working out.
Great. Great way. Let me add real quick before I forget. One really big reason that would vouch for your thought on tight end is the fact that I feel like the last three cycles they've, I won't say desperately, but they've like actively tried to find a second guy
to take two in the class.
And then it turns into a situation where the attitude, and maybe rightfully so, becomes, you know, we're going to go after, you know, because it's been the tight end cycle has been almost identical the last like 4 years. You talk about Schoonmaker in 18, All in 19, Hibner in, or who'd they take in 20 at tight end? I don't remember.
It was Hibner. And then Hibner. Hanson.
Sorry. Yep. So exact same situation where those four guys, and it right now it's the same thing in 22 with Marlon Klein. They got a really, really early tight end commitment from a guy that they loved. You know, I mean, Schoonmaker was a kid, played corner in high school at a tight end size, you know, was a kid, felt like an under the radar type, the same way they felt about Sean McCune, who's still in the NFL.
Yeah. On a roster.
Right. Get a guy early that they love, but then they just can't convince the right talent to be the second guy. You know, you got like guys like Theo Johnson. They're trying with Oscar Delp this cycle, the same deal where it's like other schools are saying, hey, you know, you can be the guy for us at tight end. Why would you go to Michigan? They already have a tight end, four-star tight end committed, you know, type deal. So in that regard, this is built up over 3 or 4 years where they've only signed one guy, you know? And so it's going to be like, and so I could see where, and yeah, I don't think the production at tight end has been particularly, you know, Eric All, yeah, really struggled last season.
The first year they don't have someone like the past few years. I mean, they knew they had Gentry and McCune in 2017. In 2018, it was the same guys as Gentry, McCune, Eubanks. In 2019, it was McCune Eubanks. Last year, it was Eubanks. But that kind of like experience pipeline that they had,
right?
Because of last season was only a half season, you know, Eric Aull didn't really get the that much experience under his belt.
Yep. No, it's a position that doesn't get talked about enough, I don't think, because it is something that seems, despite the speed and space transition, I think tight end is still central to what Michigan wants to do, particularly in the run game. So, and it's always, it's speed and space or not, tight end is always a position where if you have the right guy, can be your biggest matchup on the field, or biggest mismatch on the field in the passing game too. So
look at how many elite NFL offenses have a really good tight end. I mean, I think it's, you might argue that it's all of them do. So it's, yeah, I think it's important. And then the last position group that I was thinking of, this is more of a take someone either that you really liked as a recruit or that is like a very well-known name. They don't have that many scholarship wide receivers because of the attrition that they've had. I think there was a time where they were thinking about trying to take four receivers in this cycle just to get the scholarship numbers up. They ended up only taking two because Worthy ended up leaving. So I think, and then Giles Jackson transferred. And so I think Michigan, you know, when I went back and looked and watched these games, I actually felt of all the position groups, the receivers was the one that I was the most higher on. And that I was like, you know, I don't think it was talked enough about how well Cornelius Johnson played or Mike Sain was still, he had a couple drops, but his finish to the season or Ronnie Bell's season. But same time, I think they feel like they could probably use, I think they're at either six or seven scholarship receivers. I'm going off the top of my head there. If someone pops in, you know, thinking like a Wandale Robinson that went from Nebraska to Kentucky, someone like that, that, you know, Michigan is like, hey, I, you know, I remember recruiting you. You're someone that we could use. You might as well throw your name in the hat. So anyway, that's probably enough transfer talk for now. Obviously, if anyone commits or if they offer anyone, there will be more of a discussion to be had. But let's talk a little bit of softball. Steve, I don't know how many games you've been able to watch this year, obviously without things being in person. We're all confined kind of to the TVs during much of the season. And softball is a difficult sport because they, you know, Big Ten Network puts like three games on a weekend, and it's often Michigan, but it's not always Michigan. So I've been able to watch a few. The team is 36-6. I'm unofficially calling that a record for most Big Ten wins by a sport in a season. I don't think I've heard of teams playing 30, or I mean, I don't think anyone's ever played 42 Big Ten games, but 36, unofficially calling that a record. A lot of wins. They won 15 of their last 16. And then the NCAA tournament selection is made, and they are effectively the number 17 team in the country. Cool. But that also means that they're going across the country to play Washington, a team that probably shouldn't be a 16 seed. I mean, they were ranked fifth a week ago in the coaches poll. And so I think they split their final series or whatever. So there's reason why they fell, but 16th, I think everyone in the Pac-12 is kind of like, how could Washington be falling that far? So Steve, we'll start with the controversy before we talk about the substance of the team. I think this is the most on the record I've ever heard the SEC bias be discussed. I think Arizona's softball coach talked, look, the SEC network, it's basically ESPN. They have softball and baseball on all the time. You know, they get to put all these regional games on that station if they want to. And his inference was basically, you know, the selection committee wants these games on TV. They want the teams with the big followings. So they're going to put the SEC in charge. I mean, SEC in the last 3 years, they're a good conference. In the last 3 years, they've produced seven College World Series teams. That is second most in the country behind the Pac-12, who had 10. But this year, the SEC is hosting half of the NCAA tournament regionals, 8 of the 16, while the Pac-12 is hosting, I believe, 4. And the Pac-12 was punished. They didn't, they did regional non-conference games. So it had to be, you know, Mountain West, Western Athletic Conference, Big Sky Conference teams. And then the Big Ten, they're not a very good softball conference, but Northwestern's a 4 seed in their regional. Minnesota, I think, is a 3 seed. Michigan's a 2 seed. So it seemed like there was a little bit of bias against Michigan for not playing any non-conference games. And then I also think there was some Pac-12 bias. And part of that is the lack of non-conference. That is fewer data points. But I think a lot of coaches are inferring there is an SEC favoritism in part due to the increased television exposure that the SEC will provide. So Steve, I know you're not following the softball stuff all year, but I know you've caught up on Carol Hutchins. She was pretty blunt with her assessment. She thinks there's a bias against one conference in particular. That was her quote. Your thoughts on this whole ordeal?
Just from like a logic standpoint, I don't think these coaches all come out publicly unless there's just you, because you can never, it's one of those things you can't factually prove, right? But like the fact that they all come out so vehemently about it to me says that there's definitely credence to what they're feeling and what they, you know, their thoughts on it, right? I mean, it's like you said, it's not as if it was just Big Ten coaches. You have Pac-12 coaches also involved. Yeah, follow the money, right? It's especially anytime it comes to the SEC, in a lot of sports.
And it's just plausible enough that it's like, okay. I mean, it's not like the SEC is like some chump conference. I mean, they do have a lot of really good teams.
Oh yeah.
A lot of different teams make the College World Series. You know, I mentioned the 7, but it's not like the same 3 every year. I think they do have the best conference in college softball. But a couple of those schools probably got higher seeds than you would think.
Right. And that's, you know, I think that's where the crux of their argument lies. So, yeah, Michigan's got a weird road now to get back to the World Series, you know, and it's going to be interesting to see. It's what's kind of interesting, though, is like, isn't Washington was one of the kind of the teams that got screwed over too?
Yeah.
So it's like the screwed over bowl, you know, between Michigan and Washington, who will have a bigger chip on their shoulder, you know, and win and move on. So actually kind of creates in a weird way, despite the fact that we probably agree that both teams got hosed in this situation, it does create for a really intriguing matchup between the two, just for that reason that they're both kind of in the same boat in a way, except Michigan's got to travel all the way out there. Right.
Well, right. And the reason it matters, you know, because Michigan's been the 17 seed a couple times, or they've been the 16 seed a couple times as well. It almost would have been better if Michigan had lost a couple games and fallen down the pecking order, because one, Washington's a tough out. Two, playing on the West Coast is really tough. Three, if they find a way to beat Washington, then they have to turn around and play Oklahoma. And that's a way tougher deal. Like I think like the Kentucky regional has Northwestern, Notre Dame. I want to say Miami of Ohio and Kentucky. Kentucky's a 14 seed, I think, or a 13 seed, but like they're beatable enough for Michigan. And if Michigan won, then they would be playing a 3 seed, 4 seed instead of like the unanimous number one team in the country in Oklahoma. It's a tough draw. I mean, someone had to be the 17 seed though. And that's more of a, you know, thing with the college baseball, college softball tournament structure, that it's like 16 teams get to host, but then the 17, 18, 19, I mean, they're traveling potentially across the country. Despite being only like a game or two back from the 14, 15, 16. So it's fascinating. You know, I'm really fascinated to see if softball makes a change, because I have never heard so many coaches claiming SEC bias, because SEC bias, that's more of a fan thing. You know, it happens all the time in football. Everyone says that ESPN is biased toward the SEC. I think there's some truth to it, but I also think they're biased toward the biggest fan bases and the best teams. And so, I think, but I usually you don't hear coaches claiming SEC bias. So I thought that was fascinating. And Carol Hutchins kind of reeled it in her second interview, and it's kind of like, hey, I said had a couple things I wanted to say. Now they're said. Now we're focused on the game. More of the traditional coach speak. But yeah, it's going to be fascinating. As far as the team itself, Steve, we were going over some of the wild stats for this team before we hit record. They lead the nation in earned run average, and they are fifth in the nation in fielding percentage. They have the Big Ten, actually two first team All Big Ten pitchers, and it's wild that, you know, Megan Bobian has a 1.14 earned run average, like 186 strikeouts in 135 innings, a 162 opponent batting average. And she is like, she looks mediocre compared to Alex Duraco, 0.88 earned run average, 0.67 whip. I don't know how often you see a whip that low in the Big Ten. And then this number blew my mind too. 252 strikeouts in 136 innings. She's allowed 58 hits and 33 walks and has struck out 252, 126 opponent batting average. So definitely a pitching led team. A little bit easier to build up these crazy numbers against the Big Ten, which doesn't have a ton of, you know, great hitting lineups. But yeah, definitely a pitching led team. I think the difference this year is I do think they actually have some bats to support the pitching. You know, Lexi Blair became Michigan's first Big Ten player of the year, which is normally an offensive award. She became the first winner for Michigan since Sierra Romero in 2016. And then Taylor Bump, Lou Allen, I think they're top five in a litany of categories, including home runs and runs batted in. So it feels like there's a little bit more juice to the lineup to help Michigan advance. I know you haven't been able to watch every game, neither have I, but your thoughts on Michigan in this regional, Washington, really, really good one pitcher. Rest of the pitching staff's okay. Really, really good one hitter. And rest of the lineup is better than okay, but nothing unstoppable. Any thoughts on the regional this weekend?
I just couldn't get over the stats. Staracco, a 0.65 whip for an entire season. I don't care who you're pitching against. That's like we were saying, that's a little more than one runner every other inning. Like, does the defense, do the infielders build like little sandcastles and stuff like, you know, we used to in Little League? Or, well, I was a little bit younger than that. I wasn't building sandcastles in Little League, but you know the deal. So, I mean, I got to think, again, I'm not the most softball guy. I'm really glad we're talking about it, though. You got to think having a great 1-2 combo from a pitching standpoint, it creates a situation where you feel like you're going to have a shot every time you go out there, right? And if you can find, if you have a hitter or two who can really step up, you know, in the big moment, a couple people that can catch fire, you know, I feel like it's always a situation where you can make a run in a tournament style setting. So got to think that's what Michigan's banking on, you know, letting their pitchers be their pitchers and do what they've done all season, and then hoping that a couple hitters can kind of have a good run. And maybe carry them, you know, to the close enough to the end to where then it just becomes a, you know, mano y mano, or, well, sorry, womano, womano, I don't know, whatever the, you know, like a one on one. I don't know how the right way to, that was the wrong way to use mano.
One on one matchups. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, a one game setting where anything can happen. So like I said, I don't follow it as well. I'll be watching it now, though. I hate to sound so fair weather, but I will be watching it now. And, you know, but yeah, no, if you can throw Starocco out every other day, who, by the way, same high school as AJ Henning, actually, Lincoln Way East in Frankfort, Illinois. So they nice. Must put out some big time athletes there. So kind of a cool little story there. I'm sure AJ will be watching closely. And so, mm-hmm. but yeah, no, always excited. And then just the other thing too, Hutch, I mean, how many Big Ten championships was it?
18.
I mean, that is
18 Big Ten Coach of the Year awards.
It's just, that doesn't even, it doesn't a generation even
of just being yeah. the best coach.
Yeah. It doesn't even register, you know, never, even when she does get talked about, it's never enough really for everything she's done. You talk about how difficult it is to build a powerhouse in softball north of the Mason-Dixon line, or out, you know, if you're not under the Mason-Dixon line or on the West Coast, you know, so never gets old to see her get accolades and you know, succeed and continue to build a program and put Michigan in a, you know, in a position to compete for a World Series. So pretty sweet. But yeah, I mean, now the real season, really, that's kind of, and that's what's interesting. Now the real season starts for Michigan, and that's what she's done for them, is to where, you know, obviously we're not surprised that Michigan won the Big Ten again and that she won Big Ten. I mean, at this point, it's more likely than not, then I guess, that she'll win those awards and that they'll win the conference. And so, you know, like I said, now the real season starts. And I would say, I got to feel like it's the same as it is in baseball. If you have two elite pitchers, you know, even maybe more so in softball, it's not like you have a 5-woman rotation, you know, you're going to have a chance
right.
to win.
No, it's really two with a third. Yeah.
Right. So you have a chance, you know, yeah. to really make a run with having elite pitching at top.
Yeah. And I think the one thing, the difference with this year versus the previous few years, because they've been in this position before where they're kind of in that 15 to 20 range. I think one year they, in 2019, they hosted, and 17 and 18, they were on the road. Actually 17, they went to Washington. But I think the one difference with this year, I think the pitching staff has a little bit more control, because that's where things get haywire with softball is these games are very low scoring. So if you have an inning where you walk two batters and maybe give up like a single and have a wild pitch, I mean, that could be the entire game. So I think the fact that both Bobian and Starocco have much better control. Michigan has its best strikeout to walk ratio since 2010. I believe they are fifth in the country in that category. They might be seventh. But regardless, that's what's allowed them to keep the earned run average down. That's what on paper should allow them to, as you mentioned, contend with anybody. You know, I think they're better than Seattle, who they play first. I think they're much better than Portland State, who is like 9 games below 500, but won their conference. You know, Washington, I think, does have a better team. I think they're a little bit more in that powerhouse arc of their program. I mean, every program has kind of their waves up and down. I think this Washington team was meant to be a little bit more of a top 10, top 5. In fact, they were a top 5 team. So it'll be tough, but I do think, you know, as you mentioned, I think that they still have the pitching. I think the pitching has a little bit better control. And then I do think they have bats and not just hitting for average, like actual power bats, seems to be returning to that. Lou Allen, Taylor Bump are kind of the main two I'm speaking about there. So I don't have a prediction because I have not watched enough Washington or Michigan softball to really offer one. I think they have more of a puncher's chance than they might have had last time they went to Washington in 2017. Yeah, I think this Michigan seems to be back on the up. And yeah, I agree. I actually did spend at least 40 minutes yesterday. I went through the Big Ten archives. Thankfully, they only started doing Coach of the Year awards in like 1985. But I went through the archives for every sport. I did not find a single coach with more than 13 Big Ten Coach of the Year awards, except for Carroll Hutchins. And I mean, to do that, because, you know, these Coach of the Year awards, sometimes they just go to the best team, but a lot of times these conferences like to kind of give it to the most surprisingly good team. So like Marsha Pankratz, I think only has five, even though she's won like two dozen Big Ten titles. Or not Marsha Pankratz, softball or gymnastics coach.
Bev Plocky.
Yeah, Bev Plocky. Yeah. She only has like five or six Big Ten Coach of the Year awards, despite winning the Big Ten every year. So it's hard to convince everyone that you were the best coach, even though you were expected to be the best team, dominated everybody, and were the best team. So this is multiple generations of dominant coaching for Carroll Hutchins. I think she won her first one in 1992 or 1993. So she went several years without winning the award and then started winning the award pretty much every year, every year, every other year. So yeah, congrats to Michigan for winning the Big Ten. You know, and we'll see what happens this weekend. Obviously we'll talk about them next week if they win. Anyways, for Steve Lorenz, I'm Zach Shaw. This has been the Wolverine 24/7 podcast. Hope you had fun. Hope you learned something. We'll see you next time.
On May 23rd.
I want to go back to normal.
What's normal?
The Paramount Plus original series, Evil Returns.
We've already hunted werewolves and demons.
And now what? A baby antichrist?
Okie dokie.
Prepare yourself.
You will not beat us.
For the end.
I have visions of hell.
Make it stop. Make it shut up.
You're not gonna survive this.
Evil, the final season. Streaming May 23rd, only on Paramount Plus.